Chapter 19. Juristech, Inc. The Juristech Museum is open Monday to Friday, a half day on Wednesday. A whole range of technologies, both past and present, is on display, including an impressive array of bookworld weaponry, gramacite traps, word dams, ejecto hats, text markers, grapheme splitters, and noun-to-verb alchemical technologies. On Tuesdays, there is a technical demonstration of the textual sieve, not to be missed. Bradshaw's Bookworld Companion, 3rd edition. I turned up at the front gate of Sense and Sensibility and showed the guards the authorization given to me by Bradshaw. The guards rang through and spoke briefly to Juristech before I was once more issued a docket and ushered in. I met the frog footman at the front door, who was surprised to see me again so soon. "You again?" he said, staring at the docket. "What do you want with Juristech?" Fortified by the mission entrusted to me by Bradshaw, I was no longer so frightened of him. "None of your business," I replied, and his face lit up. This was more how he liked it. "Labs or office?" "Labs." He guided me through the long corridors of Norland Park, down several flights of steps and an elevator or two, before we stopped outside an inconspicuous door with a pair of milk bottles outside. "The Juristech Labs," announced the frog footman. "My instructions are to wait for you."
"It'll be a long wait. Pick me up in 12 hours. Here," I said, handing him a Rubik's Cube. "See if you can figure this out."
The frog footman stared at the cube curiously. All 6 faces were quite naturally the same colour, and all was orderly and neat.
"You have to try to make it random," I said, "by twisting the faces."
The frog footman twisted the faces in a fairly haphazard manner. But try as he might, every face remained the same colour. For a bookworld puzzle, it was a classic. The lack of randomness within the orderly structure of the bookworld tended not to permit disorder. As far as I knew, no one had yet managed to scramble a Rubik's, but I thought it might pass the time for him.
"Thank you," replied the frog footman, and he sat cross-legged on the floor, twisting the cube this way and that as he tried to scramble the faces.
I knocked on the door, and it was soon answered by a small man in a brown boiler suit that was liberally covered in oil stains, food, and science merit badges.
"Good Lord," he said when he saw me. "Thursday? Come inside, quick."
Once safely away from the prying ears of the frog footman, I explained who I was, or, more important, who I wasn't, and showed Professor Plum the authorization from Bradshaw.
"Did he give you a code word?"
"What?"
"A code word."
"The commander didn't say anything about a code word."
"Correct. There is no code word, but only Bradshaw would know that. Follow me."
The basement was twice the size of a cathedral, and quite full to capacity with machinery. An army of technicians scurried around looking purposeful, while lights blinked on and off as arcs of electricity discharged into the air at regular intervals.
"That's mostly for effect," explained Plum as we moved among the machines. "It's sometimes of equal importance to have a machine's form and function in equilibrium. Who wants an italicizer that can be carried around in the pocket? Much better to have a large device that flashes lights randomly and occasionally goes bzzz."
I agreed, even if I'd never seen an italicizer, much less used one.
"All this technology," I mused. "Is there any limit to what you can do?"
"If there is, we haven't found it," replied Plum.
"We can figure out most technologies, and those that we can't are subcontracted to Technobabble. Trademark, Industries, which can usually cobble something together. The good thing about being in the book world is that we aren't hampered by anything as awkward as physical laws. The real world must be hideously annoying to do science in, but given how difficult it is, I suppose breakthroughs are of greater value. In here, for example, perpetual motion machines are quite feasible.
What's stopping us from using them?
Finding a way to make them stop. Once we've figured that out, we'll have perpetual engines in every minicab and bus in the book world.
He paused, while I stared at a machine that could transform dark humour to sarcasm and then back again, with no loss of narrative mass.
As you know, continued Plum, the Council of Genres permits us to suspend the rules of physics in order that we can develop the somewhat unique technologies that the book world requires. See this?
We had stopped next to a large machine that seemed to be nothing but a riveted tube about a yard thick running through the entire length of the workshop. It appeared through one wall and then vanished out the other. If I hadn't known any better, I would have thought it a throughput pipe or a footnotophone conduit.
This is just a small part of the large metaphor collider.
What does that do?
Professor Plum stopped for a moment at the control panel. You know we've got a serious metaphor deficit at present?
I nodded.
The problem was well documented. Most of fiction's rhetorical power, dramatic irony, and pathos were brought naturally by the mighty metaphoric river that snaked about the island. But the huge influx of novels in the past century had exacted a burden on the waterway, as the much-needed metaphor was abstracted on a massive scale, and these days it was no longer considered possible that the river could supply all of fiction's requirements. Hence the trade in raw metaphor, and Juristech's attempts to synthesize it.
This collider, continued Professor Plum, will take depleted metaphor, simile, in effect, and accelerate it in a circular trackway over 18 miles long to a velocity approaching 95% of absurd, at which point it will be collided with indisputable fact. There is a brief flash of energy as the two different modes of communication are fused together and then explode in a burst of high-energy subcomprehension particles. We then record the event as traces on a sheet of onion skin paper.
The flimsy blue variety?
Exactly. In this manner, we hope not only to figure out the individual building blocks of story in order to have a better understanding of how it all works, but also to use it as a way of extracting usable quantities of metaphor from even the most prosaic, tired, or clumsily constructed simile.
Does it work?
I was just about to test it. You can help if you want.
I said I would be delighted, and Plum pointed me in the direction of a lidded crucible that was steaming gently to itself.
You'll find some tongs and gloves over there. I need that simile in the accelerator chamber.
He carried on with his measurements. The crucible was steaming, not from heat, but from cold. Liquid nitrogen was keeping a raw simile in an inactive state. So much so that I couldn't tell what it was, as the meaning and illusion were all contracted and frozen into one lump. I put on the glove, and using the wooden pincers, placed the simile in the acceleration chamber.
"Excellent," said Plum,
who closed the door and spun a wheel on the front to effect a secure lock. He then pressed a button, and there was a low humming noise, which gradually increased in pitch as the simile started to move around the accelerator. There was a dial marked absurd velocity, and the needle began to rise as the simile zipped around at ever-increasing speeds.
"The Council of Genres is very keen to have this up and running as soon as possible," he said, staring at the dials carefully. "Synthesizing metaphor is the holy grail of the book world, if you don't count finding the holy grail, which, confusingly, is also the holy grail of the book world."
The large metaphor collider had by now wound itself up to a whine so high-pitched that I couldn't hear it, and all the equipment on the desk was vibrating. As the needle nudged up to 0.95 absurd, Plum took a deep breath and pressed the red button, which instantaneously brought indisputable fact into the path of the absurdly fast simile.
It is difficult to describe what happened next. The machine changed from being something akin to an engine with the throttle stuck wide open to that of a brave new dawn. I saw the clouds open and the rain stop. The lark ascended, and I saw St. John on the island of Patmos, and a new heaven and a new earth. I saw... But in another second, those feelings had vanished, and all we were left with was the collider humming down to speed.
"What was that?" I asked.
"A sudden flash of pure metaphor," replied Plum, excitedly. "This kind of event usually liberates about 120 picomets."
"Is that safe?"
"Don't worry," he said with a smile. "The background metaphor level is about 50 picomets, and a fatal dose is up around the 40 millimet mark. You'd have to do something daft for that to happen. Although there have been accidents. A few years ago, a colleague of mine was experimenting with a few grams of dead metaphor when it went critical. He was bathed in almost 100 millimets, and started barking on about Prometheus stealing fire from the gods before he exploded into a ball of fire and ascended into the night sky, where he could be seen for many weeks. A salutary lesson of the dangers of playing with metaphor. Wrecked the laboratory, too. Let me see."
Professor Plum pulled the single sheet of onion skin from the annihilation chamber and looked at it, brows knitted. The paper had recorded the subword particles. Some were dotted, others coloured, some hatched. There was even a legend at the bottom explaining what each one meant. "Fiction has no time for lengthy and potentially confusing data analysis, so experimentation is always followed by easily interpretable and generally unequivocal results."
"That's alliteration," said Plum, tracing the various paths with his finger. "Anaphora, epistrophe, epanalepsis, analepsis, hyperbole, and polyptoton."
In all, he could list 29 sub-meaning particles, but of pure metaphor, there was no evidence at all.
"You felt it, though, didn't you?"
I answered that I had, a feeling of a new dawn and old things being swept away. Plum stared at the paper for a long time, so long, in fact, that I thought he might have gone to sleep standing up and might need catching when he fell over.
"Well," he said at last, "back to the drawing board."
"But we felt something, didn't we?" I said.
"Without proof, we've got nothing," he said, in a resigned voice. "Perhaps metaphor has no mass. If so, I'm very surprised. Although it might explain why dark reading matter is undetectable. It could be mostly metaphorical. Come on, let's get you real."
The professor led me to the back of the workshop, past the entrance to a scrubbing device for de-clicheing otherwise healthy idioms, and down a corridor to a door obscured by several discarded packing cases and a stack of unread copies of the almost fatally dull Juris Tech Review.
"We haven't used the jumper for over 18 months," he explained, struggling with a padlock that had grown rusty with age. "Not since the imaginatively titled Real World Travel Ban banned all travel to the real world."
"Why the ban?"
"I didn't ask, and neither should you. If anyone at the CFG gets wind of this, you and I are nothing but text."
I didn't like the sound of this.
"But Bradshaw..."
"Bradshaw is a good man," interrupted Plum.
"But in matters like this, he'd deny he even knew you. And me. And himself, if it came to that."
"I agree with him. To maintain the integrity of jurisfiction, I would accept being reduced to a bucket of graphemes, and so should you." He left me thinking about this, and pulled open the door. He paused, the interior of the lab a dark hole.
"You can leave me now, if you want to."
"No, I'm okay," I said, even if I wasn't. "Let's just get on with it, yes?" He turned on the light to reveal a large room that was musty and hung with cobwebs.
Occasionally, there was a low rumble, and dust trickled from the ceiling.
"The Carnegie Underpass," explained Plum. "It runs directly overhead."
In the middle of the room was a large machine that looked like a collection of sieves, each lined up, one in front of the other. The sieves began with one that might have been designed to make chips, so long as you could hurl a potato at it fast enough, and the rest were of rapidly decreasing mesh, until the penultimate one was no more than a fine wire gauze. The last of all was a thin sheet of silver that shimmered with the microscopic currents of air that moved around the workshop. Beyond this was the wide end of a copper funnel, with the sharp end finishing in a point no bigger than a pin, and beyond this a small drop of blue something or other within a localized gravitational field that kept it suspended in the air. Around the room was an array of computers covered with more dials, levers, switches, and meters than I had ever seen before.
"What exactly is it?"
I asked, not unnaturally, and with a certain degree of trepidation.
"It's the large textual sieve array," he explained. "Although the construction and methodology of textual sieves remain generally unexplained, they can be used for a number of functions. Cross-triangulation searches, the locking of text within books, and more controversially, for making fictional people real, even if for only a short period."
"How long?"
"I can send you out for 48 hours, but Bradshaw insisted you go for only 12. As soon as that time is up, you'll spontaneously return. We'll send you at midday, and you'll be out at midnight, pumpkin hour. If you want to stay longer, you'll have to Blue Fairy, and then you're there for good, and you'll have to suffer the worst rigours of being real, aging, death, and daytime television."
The 12-hour pumpkin option suited me fine, and I told him so. I'd heard many stories about the real world, and although it sounded an interesting place to visit, you'd not want to live there.
"So how does it work?" I asked.
"Simplicity itself. You see this howitzer?"
He pointed at a large caliber cannon that was pointed directly at the sieves. It was mounted on a small carriage and was gaily decorated with red stars and had the Flying Zambinis painted on the side.
"You are placed in this cannon and then fired into the array at 0.346 absurd speed. The mesh of the first sieve is quite broad, to break down your base description into individual words. The next breaks the words down into letters, and then the letters are divided further into subcalligraphic particles, until you hit the silver sheet, which has holes in it 1/10 the size of a polypopton. After that," he concluded, as he tapped the large funnel, "your descriptive dust is compressed in the pitmanizer to a concentrated pellet of ultra-dense prose, where the several thousand words of your description take up less space than 1/1,000,000th of a period. Put it another way, if all fiction were compressed to the same degree, it would take up the space of an average-sized rabbit."
"I like comparative factoids like that."
"Me too. This tiny speck of you is then injected at speed into a drop of anti-book, where your essence is rebuilt into something closely resembling human. By controlling the sieve array, I can drop you wherever you want in the real world."
"Does it hurt?"
"Quite a lot, actually," he admitted, "but only fleetingly. You'll barely have enough time to scream before it will be over. The return is not so dramatic. You'll simply find yourself in our arrival suite, which is just behind that door."
"Do you have any advice?"
"I've never been there myself," confessed Plum. "But they say if you can handle the first 10 minutes, you're good for the whole 12 hours. If you can't hack it, then just find a quiet wardrobe in which to hide until the free return brings you back."
I found his comments disconcerting. "What is there that one might not be able to handle?" Professor Plum made a clicky noise with his tongue.
"It's highly disorderly," he explained. "Not like here. There is no easily definable plot.
and you can run yourself ragged wondering what the significance can be of a chance encounter. You'll also find that for the most part there is no shorthand to the narrative, so everything happens in a long and painfully drawn-out sequence. Apparently the talk can be confusing. For the most part, people just say the first thing that comes into their heads.
Is it as bad as they say it is?
I've heard it's worse. Here in the book world, we say what needs to be said for the story to proceed. Out there? Well, you can discount at least 80% of chat as just meaningless drivel.
I never thought the percentage was that high.
In some individuals, it can be as high as 92%. The people to listen to are the ones who don't say very much.
Oh.
There are fun things, too, said Plum, sensing my disappointment. You'll get used to it in the end. But if you go out there accepting that 75% of talk is utter twaddle and 85% of people's lives are spent dithering around, you won't go far wrong. But above all that, don't be annoyed or distracted when random things happen for absolutely no purpose.
There's always a purpose, I said, amused by the notion of utter pointlessness, even if you don't understand what it is until much later.
That's the big difference between here and there, said Plum. When things happen after a randomly pointless event, all that follows is simply unintended consequences, not a coherent narrative thrust that propels the story forward.
I rolled the idea of unintended consequences around in my head.
Nope, I said finally. You've got me on that one.
It confuses me too, admitted Plum. But that's the real world for you. A brutal and beautiful place, run for the most part on passion, fads, incentives, and mathematics. A lot of mathematics.
That's it? I asked, astonished by the brevity in which Plum could sum up the world that had, after all, made us.
Pretty much, he replied glumly. And some very good cuisine, and the smells. You'll like those, I assure you. And real sex. Not like the oddly described stuff we have to make do with in here.
I assure you, I'm not going to the real world for the sex.
When tourism was permitted, many visitors used it for little else. Anything that is impossible to describe adequately in the book world was much sought, and, coincidentally, usually beginning with C. Cooking, copulation, Caravaggio, coastlines, and chocolate.
Will you do me a favour and bring some back? I adore chocolate. As much as you can carry, in fact. And none of that Lindt or Nestle muck. Cadbury's the thing.
I promised him I would, and he opened the hatch at the back of the cannon.
Good luck, he said. Don't worry if it seems a bit odd to begin with. You're made in the image of the flesh and bloods, so there's nothing you can't figure out as long as you keep your wits about you. It helps if you crouch tight like a hedgehog. It's why Mrs. Tiggywinkle was so good at moving across.
I crawled inside and crunched myself up into the fetal position. Plum instructed me to hold my breath when he reached the count of two, as it helped to have a breath in you when you arrived, since breathing out can give a good indication of how breathing actually works. I thanked him for the advice, and he closed the hatch. I looked along the barrel of the cannon to the muzzle, and beyond that to the series of textual sieves that would chop me into the smallest component parts imaginable. I admit it, I was nervous. I waited for about a minute in the gloom. And then, when nothing had happened, I called out.
Sorry, came Plum's voice. I'm just winding her up to speed. If I don't get you to exactly 0.346 of absurd speed, all you'll be is a tattered mass of text caught in the sieves. If I fire you too fast, you'll be embedded in the back of the laboratory.
What would happen then?
Paper over you, I suppose. I wasn't particularly reassured by this, but waited patiently for another half minute until I heard a faint whine that grew in pitch as Plum counted down from 10. When he got to 5, the whine had grown so loud I could hardly hear him, so I guessed when 2 would be and took a deep breath.
I was just thinking that perhaps this wasn't such a great idea after all, and I should really be getting back to my series, and staying there for a sensible period of time, such as forever, when there was a noise, like 1,000 metallic frogs all croaking at the same time, and my body was suddenly skewered by 1,000 hot needles. Before I could cry out, the pain passed, and after a low hum and a sensation of treacle, Klein Blue and Wagner all mixed together, but not very well, there was a brilliant flash of light.